Yeah, I wanted to just continue something I was talking about last week, because the parshios of Matan Torah really continue through the end of Parshas Mishpatim. And if you go back to Yisro Perek Yotes, and we talk about the preparations that the Jewish people have to undergo for Matan Torah, so you see a certain sequence of events, right? They come to Midbar Sinai, Rosh Chodesh Sivan. Okay? And they get the Torah either on the 6th of Sivan or on the 7th of Sivan. There's a machlokas, actually, what day we got the Torah. When I say, well, actually, I'm going to be more precise. What day we got the Torah is a little ambiguous term, but what day we heard the Aseres Hadibros, or at least the first two of the Aseres Hadibros. According to one view, it was on the 6th of Sivan. According to the other view, it was on the 7th of Sivan. Now that gives rise to a very, very famous kasha, which I'm not going to talk about today, but just remember the kasha, and that is that if we have a machlokas, whether the Torah was given on the 6th of Sivan or the 7th of Sivan, then why is it so obvious that we celebrate Shavuos on the 6th of Sivan? In other words, they're not arguing when the holiday of Shavuos is. Now, in Chutz La'aretz, you got 6 and 7, but that's only the thing of the Yom. But in Eretz Yisrael, we only celebrate on the 6th. And nobody says, you don't celebrate on the 6th. So apparently, like the Man D'Omer that we got the Aseres Hadibros on the 7th, we're celebrating Shavuos the day before we got the Aseres Hadibros. That's a famous, famous question. That's a question of the Magen Avraham. But he makes a point, the following. He makes a point. The truth of the matter is that the holiday of Shavuos is intrinsically not Mekushar with either the 6th or the 7th. Because how does the Torah define the holiday of Shavuos? The Torah does not define it in terms of a calendar date at all. The Torah says that you celebrate the holiday the 50th day of the Omer. And you start counting the Omer the second day of Pesach. Now, whether or not the 50th day of the Omer is going to be the 6th of Sivan depends on the length of the intervening months between Pesach and Shavuos. And the two intervening months are the rest of Nisan and Iyar. Now, we know a month can have either 29 days with Rosh Chodesh day 30, or a month could have 30 days with Rosh Chodesh day 31. In the time of the Beis HaMikdash, it all depended on when witnesses came. Today, we have a predetermined calendar. Now, in our predetermined calendar, Nisan is 30 and Iyar is 29. So by definition, when you count 50 days from the second day of Pesach, you will always hit the 6th of Sivan. But in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, there were two other possibilities. They could have been both 30, or they could have been both 29. Of course, it could also have been reversed, where Nisan 29 and Iyar 30, but that would be the same. Right? But in terms, two different possibilities is both 29 or both 30. Now, if both are 30, so you have two extra days, so the 50th day is going to be earlier in Sivan, because you have, right? So Shavuos will be the 5th of Sivan. If both are 29, you're missing a day, so Shavuos is going to be the 7th of Sivan. In other words, the Torah basically says, sometimes Shavuos will be the 5th of Sivan, sometimes it will be the 6th of Sivan, sometimes it'll be the 7th of Sivan, whatever is the 50th day of the Omer. So in a sense, the calendar date when the Ten Commandments were given is not necessarily relevant on the holiday of Shavuos. There is a machlokas in the Gemara. Were the Ten Commandments given on the 6th of Sivan or the 7th of Sivan? And I asked Akasha, so how come we celebrate Shavuos on the 6th of Sivan? The answer is we don't really celebrate Shavuos on the 6th of Sivan. We celebrate Shavuos on the 50th day of the Omer, which in our present calendrical configuration will always fall on the 6th. But Shavuos is not linked to a calendar. However, that doesn't fully answer the question for the following reason. That would be good if you could say that whether it was 6th or 7th, it was given on the 50th day of the Omer, that's all that counts. But the problem is you can show that it was not given on the 50th day of the Omer. That if you hold, in fact, whether it was the 6th or the 7th, it was not the 50th day of the Omer. Because here's the problem. The Braisa says we left Mitzrayim on a Thursday. And the Torah was given on a Shabbos. So let's figure this out. If you leave Mitzrayim on a Thursday, so the second day of Pesach starts on a Friday. The 49 days are over on Thursday. Friday to Thursday are 49 days. Friday to Friday is 50 days. Shabbos is day 51. So whether it was the 6th or the 7th, it was the 51st day of the Omer. So you're in trouble no matter what you say. In other words, there's a machlokas what the calendar date was, and that depends on the intervening months. But either way, it was not the 50th day of the Omer, it was the 51st day of the Omer. Right? So those are famous questions, but again, it's important just to kind of compartmentalize things and recognize that the machlokas in the Gemara, if the Ten Commandments were the 6th or the 7th, has absolutely no bearing on when we celebrate Shavuos. And even if it's true that the calculations don't work out well, it is not a machlokas about the Yom Tov of Shavuos. It's a machlokas about whether Rosh Chodesh, Sivan, right? We got the Torah on Shabbos, everybody's moda. So if Shabbos, it was the 7th of Sivan, that means Rosh Chodesh was Sunday. If Shabbos is the 6th of Sivan, Rosh Chodesh was Monday. And the machlokas in the Gemara was, when did they come to Midbar Sinai on Sunday, or did they come on Monday? And that's I think Gemara is a different psukim for this. Okay, but be this it may, whether they came on Sunday or Monday, whether the Torah was given on the 6th or the 7th, for that week, they had certain hachanas they had to do. And the first hachana was, they are makabel, a mission statement from Hashem. And that mission statement is very, very important. That our job is to be a segula mikol ha'amim, a precious treasure amongst all the nations, mamleches kohanim, a kingdom of kohanim, goy kadosh, a holy nation. Now, what is that a charge to do? That we have to live our lives in a way that sanctifies Hashem's name and brings glory to Hashem's name. You know, we use today the word skula for any variety of quick fixes in life. You know, what's a skula for a shidduch, right? What's a skula for parnasa, right? Well, skula is like, you know, amulets, red strings. So somebody once asked the Sfas Emes, what's the best skula for something? The Sfas Emes says, the best skula is Vayisam Li Segula Mikol Amin. When you live your life, that you are a precious treasure to Hashem, that's your best skula. Now they say for Parnassa too, they say, you know, there's a skula, somebody wrote, they have a skula going all the way back from Adam Harishon, even before Avraham Avinu, a skula for Parnassa, Gevaldik, Adam Harishon. Says, what is that? It says, Bezeyas Apecha Tocha Lechem, you know, get a job, you know, it's a skula for Parnassa. By the sweat of your brow, you know, eat bread. That's the best skula for Parnassa. But okay. But of course, avada, a person needs tefillah and siyata d'shmaya there too. There's no such thing as anything automatic, even in that. Okay, but in any event, so that's the mission statement. Mamleches kaihanim, goy kadosh, skula mikol ha'amim. Right, so that's called a mission statement. Second thing that had to happen was the physical separation of men and women from sexual relationships. For 3 days, they had to be separated, because once again, the frivolity of that type of intimacy was inconsistent with the concentration on Kedusha. and that only lasted for 3 days. After that, in other words, that was Matan Torah, and after that it was permitted. There was only one person who, from that prohibition onward, remained permanently celibate. That was Moshe Rabbeinu himself. And that's not because Hashem told him to do it. Moshe did it on his own, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu was maskev that for him it was correct. If you remember, this is a very difficult thing for us, really, because in many, many ways, you know, we look to the tzaddikim as people that we emulate and copy. But Chazal go way, way out of their way to emphasize over and over again that this particular attribute of Moshe Rabbeinu is not to be copied, right? Unlike the Catholic Church that says holy people are supposed to be celibate, we have exactly the opposite. It says there's a mitzvah in the Torah to marry and to be fruitful and multiply. And it says for a person to live without a wife when they're ready to be married is a big sin. So in a sense, Moshe Rabbeinu was not to be emulated here, but nevertheless he did take on permanent celibacy as a result. And the third aspect, so there's mission statements, separation of the genders, and the third aspect was physically distancing themselves from the holiness of Har Sinai, that neither person nor animal could approach the mountain because there was going to be revelation of the divine presence. Now, that Kedusha too was temporary, because after the Aseres HaDibros, there would be a great shofar blast, and that shofar blast would signify the Siluk HaShechina, which would allow people to approach Har Sinai. That is actually why one of the reasons at the end of Yom Kippur, we end Yom Kippur with a shofar blast, because that signifies that the divine presence that was so accessible to us has now gone up to, in Shemayim. It's not, we're not as close to that Shechina anymore.
How could Moshe separate from his wife without, I mean, having two boys, that's not...
He wasn't the kind pruvu. Yeah, right. Well, that's a very, very good question. Obviously, it was... you know, this is really what Chazal say. Chazal say that Moshe had become so angelic, so sanctified, so holy at that point, that he was really no longer working within the bounds of a regular human being. In other words, it's not a role model, Pashut. It's something that's... it goes beyond righteousness. It was a separate spiritual level of being. You know, we don't really understand if that's true. Now,
can you assume he had no daughters just because some people say that?
I think that's a safe assumption. I don't think it's recorded anywhere. I'd be very interested to find that out. Now, of course, let me just remind you, according to Beit Shammai, you are Mekayim Pru Urvu with two boys. But again, it would be fair to say that Moshe Rabbeinu, who did Moshe Rabbeinu pasuk like Beit Shammai? That would be hard to say, yeah.
In general, when they list, like, people who, say, people who had certain sons in the desert, if you're going to take it literally that women had 6 children every, you know, pretty much every year, it's impossible that they're listing all the...
No. It is true that daughters are very often not recorded.
Right.
I think that's true, but in Moshe Rabbeinu's case, we would tend to at least be aware of it. Mm-hmm. For example, with Avraham Avinu, there's no daughter that's recorded, and yet Chazal have a drasha that he had a daughter, right? So Chazal make drashas, at least. With Moshe Rabbeinu, I'm not aware, at least, of any drasha about that. Now, a little more on this. Har Sinai, right? So we have what? So the three hachanas are mission statements, separation of husband and wife, and separation from Har Sinai. Oh, I should also add one other thing. We also went to the mikvah. In other words, remember, Chazal actually darshan that Matan Torah, or went to a spring, whatever. They didn't have a mikvah as something constructed, but we went to whatever water was there. Chazal actually say that Matan Torah was a conversion of Am Yisrael. A conversion. Because what are the three steps of conversion for a man? Bris Milah, which we had in Pesach. Immersion in a mikvah, which was Tevilah. And the third is Kabbalah HaMitzvos, which is Naaseh V'Nishma. And actually, it was Man HaMikdash, there's a fourth one, and that is the Ger had to bring a Korban. And we find at the end of Mishpatim that Shlomim and Olos were brought, and they were sprinkled with blood. The Gemara has a drasha that when there's no Mikdash, the Korban is not Ma'akev. But when there's a Mikdash, part of the Geiris was bringing a Korban. Right, so all of the halachas of Geiris are derived from Matan Torah. In fact, the Maral asks the Kasha, the halacha is that, what's the halacha, that when a person converts, they're considered to be a newly created being. Ger sheniskayer kekatan shenai ladami. Now that has some very surprising ramifications. That means the oraisa, if a father and daughter convert, they're allowed to get married. The oraisa, midrabanan, not because of marizayim. The oraisa, mother and son, brother and sister. So fret the maral akasha, a bazai. If the whole Klal Yisrael was Gersh Nizkar Katn Shanai Ladami, it should come out that they should be permitted. Right? So I mentioned it to you, yeah. So I mentioned it to you last time that the Maral's Mechadesh, that since the Geiris of Matan Torah was a compulsion Geiris, Kafale Markagigis, so you don't apply the rule of Gersh Nizkar. Okay. But be it as it may, it's worthy to think a little bit about the fact that Har Sinai's Kedusha was only a temporary, ephemeral Kedusha that was nistalik. Why should that be so? The place where the Torah was given should not have permanent Kedusha? But let's think about it another way. Isn't it odd that the Torah was not given in Eretz Yisrael? The Torah was given in a Midbar. So the Mefarshim say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu specifically chose a place of no significance so that a person should internalize the idea that Torah is above location. In other words, if I would have gotten the Torah in a holy place, I might have thought, oh, when I'm in Kedusha, when I'm in holiness, that's when I can keep the Torah. But when I'm in a place, a bad environment, Hashem can't expect me to keep the Torah. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu B'davka gave the Torah in a place that was devoid of spirituality to teach me that the Torah is above Makom. So if you think about that, it would have been nonsensical for Hashem to then say, the place where I gave you the Torah becomes holy. Because the whole message of Matan Torah there was, place doesn't matter, so we cannot turn around and say, the place is significant. See, the whole idea is that Makom doesn't matter. Now, in a way, that creates some contradictions. On one hand, it's a Dover Pashut, that the optimal kiyum of the Torah is, of course, in Eretz Yisrael. There's no question. But at the same time, a person has to know that the kesher to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to Shemiras HaMitzvos HaLimud HaTorah, is a kesher you have everywhere. That's what the Chafetz Chaim says when Hashem tells Moshe Rabbeinu by the burning bush, take off your shoes, because the place where you're standing is holy ground. The Chafetz Chaim says that's Hashem's words to each and every one of us. The place where you are is holy. And that's an important thought. You know, sometimes we think to ourselves, you know, if we don't have yichus, we don't have connections, we don't have family, we don't have background, and we think, oh, if only I would come from 100 generations of rabbis, if only, of course that's no guarantee, you know, Karl Marx also came from many generations of rabbis, you know, if only I would have the right family, if only I'd be in the better yeshiva, though there's no better yeshiva, but you know, better Rebbe, whatever it is. But a person has to understand that it's true that there are people who may have many, many milos that I don't have or you don't have. But it's also true that in your history, in your background, in your experience, there are many, many milos that somebody else doesn't have. And in where Hashem puts you is the way that you will find Hashem based on who you are. And that's the idea of makom doesn't matter. Where you are doesn't matter. Because in every place where you are, you can find Kedusha. Yeah.
But the place where they were wasn't holy, but the conditions they were under, they were getting man, they were like, there was a lot of holiness in the circumstances.
No, I
that
understand.
Were
the Midbar was a holy environment. No, that's very, very true. So you're still saying that if you wanted to be a skeptic here, you could argue, well, they still had optimal conditions which didn't involve distraction. In fact, the Gemara even has a lashon that the Torah could only be given to a generation that was eating man, because when you're busy with parnasa, it's much, much harder to concentrate. It's a good question, and in a way that kind of undermines this point, but nevertheless, HaKadosh Baruch Hu at least wanted to be merames to the notion of not giving it in a holy place, and that is why specifically Har Sinai doesn't become a holy place, because if it became a holy place, you could then make the same logical argument, oh, the Torah is binding on us there because it was a holy place, right? All right. Now, the problem, and I alluded to it very quickly, but I want to go over it again, is that, all right, so we have these preparations, right? Mission statement, separation, and separation from the mountain. We then hear the Aseret HaDibros, and it's machlokes. What did we hear? We heard the first two, right? The different opinions. We heard the first two, and then Moshe told us the other eight, or we heard all ten, or we heard the whole ten, like, in one word, and then we heard the reiteration of the first two. But then, let's go on. If you just follow the Chumash, so what happened after the Aseret HaDibros? So Hashem didn't stop talking. Right? We have the Aseret HaDibros. And then it says people saw the thunder, the lightning, etc. And they said to Moshe, you be our intermediary. But again, the way Rashi understands it, that was after the first two, not after the ten. Okay. And then Hashem talks to Moshe and he says, now, like this. The pasuk says, V'yamod ha'am me'rachok. People stood from the distance, and Moshe approached the dark cloud, Asher Sham Elokim, where God is in this dark cloud that's enveloping the mountain. And God then speaks to Moshe and says, when you build a Mizbeach, it should be of stone, it shouldn't be of metal, because metal is something that takes away life. And then he gives him mishpatim, all sorts of civil laws, bein adam lechaveiro, etc. Now, when Moshe is hearing these things after the Ten Commandments, where exactly is he? In other words, is he already... Remember, he's going to go to Mount Sinai for 40 days. Is he already there? Because the Chari, you got a problem. After all of these mishpatim, the Torah then says, Hashem says to Moshe, build a mizbeach, build an altar, sprinkle the blood, naseh v'nishma. So how do we understand this? If Moshe already is going into the dark cloud and is hearing the mishpatim, how do we understand Perek Chavdalet here? So I went over it quickly, but I want to be marich a little bit more. So there's a big machlokas, Rashi and the Ramban, how to reconstruct the sequence of events in Matan Torah. According to Rashi's Shita, and Rashi follows this a lot, we say, Ein Muktam Umu'ukher B'Torah. The Torah does not follow chronological sequence. And this is actually based on the Gemara and Masechet Shabbos. And therefore, all of the events in Perek Chavdalet are supposed to be superimposed on the events of Perek Yotes, which are pre-Matan Torah events. Which means, what do we read in Perek Chavdalet? We read the following. We read that Moshe built a Mizbeach. We read that the Jewish people were sprinkled with blood. We read that Moshe read something called Sefer HaBris, the Book of the Covenant. And in response to the Sefer HaBris, the Jewish people said, Kol Asher Diber Hashem, whatever Hashem said, Nase, we will do, even before we know what it is, and then we will hear what it is. According to Rashi, all of that is pre-Matan Torah. Mimela, according to Rashi, by the time Moshe is hearing about the Mishpatim, he is already inside of the cloud, and this is already the start of his 40 days. In other words, when it said, U'Moshe Nigash El HaRafel, Moshe goes to the cloud, according to Rashi, he's gone into the cloud, he's not going to come out till 40 days later, which is the sin of the golden calf. And the reference that Moshe is still outside of the cloud and building the altar, that is all pre-Matan Torah. Right? That is how Rashi understands this. And this is really not just Rashi making it up. This is the Gemara in Shabbos that says, Beferish, that the Mizbeach that Moshe built and sprinkling the blood, all of that was done on the 5th of Sivan, either one day or 2 days before Matan Torah, depending on whether Matan Torah was the 6th or the 7th. Now, according to Rashi, therefore, the famous statement, Naseh V'Nishma, was said before Matan Torah. Okay, before Matan Torah. The Korbanos were brought before Matan Torah. What, according to Rashi, was the Sefer HaBris that Moshe Rabbeinu read? The Sefer HaBris that Moshe Rabbeinu read? The Book of the Covenant? So Rashi says, it was all of the Torah from Bereshis until Matan Torah. As Hashem, I don't know when Moshe had time to do this, but Moshe apparently, al pi Hashem, wrote down the Torah from Bereshis until Matan Torah, and the commandments we were given in the oasis of Marah. So Moshe Rabbeinu read to them. Essentially, what did he read to them? He read to them their history. He read to them that Hashem created the world. He read to them the story of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. He read to them the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, which they had just experienced. And that is ma'orer them to say, Naseh V'Nishma. Okay, everyone understands how Rashi learns this. Therefore, according to Rashi, the point I'm making is, when it says Moshe went to the dark cloud and Hashem continued to talk to him, that's already the start of the 40 days. He's already covered up and he's not going to come out for 40 days. Yeah, second.
No, so the Ten Commandments, he wouldn't have said them yet until after the cloud, or he said it before?
No. What happened was he said them before. In other words, Moshe Rabbeinu did all these things before. Then there were the Ten Commandments. After the Ten Commandments, Moshe then goes into the cloud and he gets the Mishpatim. In other words, the Mishpatim are the first thing he hears when he's in the cloud for the 40 days. That's the first thing he hears. Although, now it's interesting, although we have a Masorah, it's not clear from the Torah itself, that in those 40 days Moshe got the whole Torah. Right? That's our Masorah. He got the 613 mitzvos. But the only thing the Chumash says he specifically got in the cloud were the Mishpatim. And the details of the Mishkan as well. I mean, what I'm saying is, the Torah, if you read the Torah later, the Chumash does not say that when Moshe was in the cloud for the 40 days, he was given the laws of Korbanos. I mean, fakert, if I read the Chumash literally, he was not given the laws of Korbanos till the Mishkan was put up. And yet, Chazal have a Masorah that even if Moshe didn't tell Bnei Yisrael the commandments till later, he got all of the commandments and all of the Torah Shebaal Peh in those 40 days. Okay, yeah.
Oh, but the written Torah he received as they were going through the desert.
Okay. Right? That's absolutely correct. You have to absolutely differentiate between the mitzvos and the narrative structures of the Torah. He got the 613 commandments the 40 days he's in Har Sinai. But he did not come back with the Sefer Torah. The events of the Torah, many of which are after Matan Torah, were either written piecemeal after they happened, or according to some opinions, he wrote them at the very end of his life. Al Pi Hashem, of course. Yeah. No, that's a very, very important point that a lot of people make a mistake. Moshe did not emerge after 40 days with the story of Korach and the Meraglim and everything else, because as I always say, it makes no sense to say that everybody are actors reading from a script. Korach didn't know ahead of time what the storyline was going to be. Okay. Now, Ramban does not like the principle, although Chazal use it, but Ramban, as a parshan of the Torah, does not like the principle of Ein Mukdam U'Mukher B'Torah. The Ramban always endeavors to interpret the Torah in a chronological manner whenever it's possible. And the Ramban, even though it's connected to Gemara and Shabbos, but the Ramban feels it is possible to interpret the Torah in the following way. Before Matan Torah, the Jews had the preparation, mission statements, separation of genders, separation from the mountain. They hear the Ten Commandments. The Jewish people are afraid. They ask Moshe to be an intermediary. Moshe goes up to the cloud, but not in the cloud. He is given all the Mishpatim. So according to this, the Mishpatim are a very strange revelation. He's given them on the day of Matan Torah itself, and he's still outside of the cloud. So they actually have a special status. In effect, the Mishpatim are really tantamount to the eight of the Ten Commandments, where they were given on the day of Matan Torah itself, but we didn't hear it from Hashem. We heard it from Moshe. In fact, it's very difficult to understand what makes the Eighth Commandments more important than the Mishpatim. I mean, they're exactly the same. In other words, we didn't hear them from Hashem in either event, but they were given on the day of Matan Torah. And on that very day, Moshe builds an altar. Builds an altar, reads the Sefer Habris, and people say, Naseh v'nishma. And therefore, the Ramban says, the reference, and Moshe approached the cloud, which appears after the Ten Commandments, does not mean he entered the cloud. He did not enter the cloud till after the altar and the Sefer Habris. But it means he approached the cloud to hear the mitzvahs from Hashem that the Jewish people were not ready to hear. So according to the Ramban, what is the Sefer HaBris that he read? So the Ramban says, Pashit. He read to them the Aseres HaDibros and the Mishpatim, because they only heard the first two commandments. Moshe Rabbeinu heard a whole bunch of laws from Hashem. Right? So you understand that the way you interpret the Book of the Covenant is going to be taloi on whether the Torah is in chronological order or the Torah is not in chronological order. It'll also depend on how you interpret the phrase in Yisro, Moshe approaches the cloud. Does he enter the cloud, which is how Rashi will have to learn, or does he stay outside of the cloud because he hasn't yet finished what he's going to do with Bnei Yisrael, right? And so all of this machloksim are connected. Now, I think I may have mentioned, I'm not sure, that the Ibn Ezra gives a third pshat in Sefer HaBris, which is actually a very logical pshat, and the Ibn Ezra can be plugged in whether you learn like Rashi or the Ramban. Whether it's before the Aseres HaDibros or after the Aseres HaDibros, the Ibn Ezra says the Sefer HaBris actually refers to the blessings and the curses of the Tochacha that appear at the end of the book of Vayikra. Now, in a way, that's quite logical, because the word bris fits much better there, because the Chumash itself calls the Tochacha a making of a bris, and the Torah, and although it's in the end of Vayikra, the Chumash itself describes it as the covenant. The Ibn Ezra's Raya is a very excellent Raya. It's the bris Asher Karas Imam B'choreif that God made for them at Sinai. So the Ibn Ezra says, what is Moshe Rabbeinu reading to them? The brachos and the klolos of the Teichacha, to which they say Naseh v'nishma. And that fits, as they say, I mean, that fits either chronological sequence. And that's the brachos and the klolos. Yeah.
Is it common in Chumash to say that somebody approached something without going in? Or is there a better word that is more often used? Or, I mean,
No, I think if anything, the subtlety of approaching might imply you didn't go in.
Right.
Because otherwise you would say vayavo.
Yeah.
La'arafel. So vayigash means you approach.
Yeah. I mean, is there a precedent somewhere else where approach definitely means entered?
I don't know. I mean, I think of Vayigash Elav Yehuda, but that did not involve entering. That's Yehuda approaches Yosef, you know. But what's a little intriguing to me is that according to Ramban, you see something highly unusual about the Mishpatim. In other words, Bishlam, according to Rashi, you know, Moshe enters the cloud. Hashem is going to give him all 613 mitzvos. Mishpatim happened to be the first ones. Even that's unusual. Even that is worthy of note. Why are Mishpatim the first commandments? But like Ramban, I think it's very, very striking that it's not just Mishpatim are the first commandments, but Mishpatim were given in the Matan Torah experience itself before Moshe even enters the cloud, while you still have the Kolos, Ubrakim, and all of those things, right? So there's something very unique about these Mishpatim, which of course reminds us of the primacy of Ben Adam L'Chavero. I'll just end here. The Mabit, the contemporary of the Beis Yosef, says a very interesting vort, and in the age of computer fonts, printing fonts, you can appreciate this. He says, you know, all of us know that the first five commandments are supposed to be Bein Adam L'Makom. And the last five are supposed to be Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. And the one exception is the fifth commandment is Kibud Aviyim, which seems to be Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, but still, by honoring your parents who give you life, you come to honor Hashem that gives you life. Okay. Now, we also know the following. We know that Chazal tell us the way the Dibros were set up, the same amount of space was taken up by the first five and the second five. They took up the same amount of surface area. Now, the problem is there are many more words in the first five than the second five. The second five are very short. Lo Sirach, Lo Sirach, right? The first five are longer. So, if you have more words that take up the same amount of surface area, then that means the font must have been smaller, right? The size of the engravings of the first five must have been smaller, and the second five must have been larger. So, if you are a nearsighted fellow, and you see Moshe Rabbeinu coming down from the mountain, before he broke the Luchos because of the Chedo Ego, he says, and you were staring and seeing what was on those Luchos, which luchos would you see first? You would see the Bein Adam L'Chaveiro before the Bein Adam L'Makom. So the Ma'abid is Mochiach here how important the mitzvahs Bein Adam L'Chaveiro are, because they would be the first thing that Klal Yisrael would see before they would see the Bein Adam L'Makom. That's what the Ma'abid brings as a raya. Okay. See you on Tuesday.